nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, two more topics that we're going to discuss in this course, and that's you should realize that there are more transistors than silicon transistors. And 3-5 transistors are important. They're commercially important in applications like RF and high frequency, but they're also a current research topic. People are even thinking about whether silicon MOSFETs can be replaced with 3-5 FETs. So I want to talk about field effect transistors today, and on Thursday we'll talk about bipolar transistors. Monday we have the final exam. I guess our last homework assignment is due on Thursday, and we'll post the solutions right afterwards. So you can, that one is on SOI. Well, this is what I'd like to talk about today. So let's start with the introduction. So there's been 3-5 transistors or gallium arsenide transistors have been around for a long, long time. And the basic device was a gallium arsenide MESFET. So it's a metal semiconductor field effect transistor. And it doesn't have a gate insulator. It has a Schottky barrier. Oh, why is that? Yeah, there just isn't a good native oxide to make a nice high-quality interface with low surface states. That's why everything was done with silicon originally, even though gallium arsenide has much higher mobilities and would make a better transistor, one would think. So to get around that, the way it's done is you can produce semi-insulating gallium arsenide wafers by a couple of different techniques. And then we could ion implant, typically, N-type dopants near the top and make a channel. We could heavily dope the source and drain. And then if we put a Schottky barrier that depletes the channel, we've got a depletion mode device. Right? You apply a reverse bias to the gate, deplete the channel, and the current drops. Or if you adjust the doping and the thickness just right, you could deplete at zero bias on the gate. You'd be off, just like a MOSFET. And then you could forward bias the gate and pull the depletion region back, and the current would flow. But you couldn't forward bias it too much, right? Why is that? It's a diode. It's a forward bias Schottky diode. The current will flow. So that's kind of a pain, but people learn to live with it. And there are some cases where it works very well. The reason it was worth learning to live with it is that the mobility in gallium arsenide is very much higher than silicon. So you get very high transconductance, you get very high speed, you get very high frequency performance. Now, there's kind of a trade-off here. You get really high mobilities in lightly doped gallium arsenide, but if you have to dope it heavily to get enough carriers in there to carry the current, then the mobility drops with doping density, just like it always does with ionized impurity scattering. So you get mobilities that are high, but not as high as they are in intrinsic gallium arsenide. Okay. Now, more recently, as you probably know, some companies are switching to high-K gate dielectrics in silicon. They're replacing SiO2 with something else that has a higher dielectric constant. So that would lead you to believe that, well, if you can do that, if you can put something else on silicon, maybe you can go back to 3-5s and put an insulator on them and make MOSFETs out of them. So this is a current research topic, and some of the best research is going on right here in Professor Yi's group here at Purdue. These are some very recent results, and you can see how the structure is built. This one is built on an indium phosphide substrate. So that has a wide band gap, if I remember right, something like 1.7 eV, something like that. And then if you put gallium, if you make an alloy, that is 53% indium and 47% gallium. It's lattice matched to indium phosphide, so there are no crystal defects. But it also has a smaller band gap, more like silicon. I think it's 6 or 7 tenths of a volt, somewhere in that regime, which is more suitable for transistors. So then there's a, this is sort of a buffer layer from the substrate. Then there's a lightly doped P layer. This is like the P well for an N-channel MOSFET. What they've done here is to put a very high indium content layer, 75% indium. That shrinks the band gap even more, lowers the effective mass even more, makes the mobility even higher, and it produces a little quantum well at the surface that confines the carriers. Okay. And then they deposit by atomic layer deposition a high-K gate dielectric aluminum oxide. And the source drain regions here are ion implanted just the way they would be in a silicon MOSFET. So the intent is to try to make it look as much as you can like a silicon MOSFET. And here are the results. So you can still see that this is still research, and there's still some issues to address, but the results are quite nice. If you look at a 200 nanometer channel length, this is log ID versus VGS, and we're used to seeing curves like that. You can see something that looks like Gittle. You can see a sub-threshold slope. I haven't figured out exactly what it is. It's not as good as silicon. And it comes up, and this is low VDS, 0.05 volts. High VDS, 0.8 volts is the blue line, and you get a lot more current. It's, in this case, it's over 100 microamps per micrometer, which, a good silicon MOSFET these days is 1,000. So it's not there yet, but it's remarkably good considering how hard these devices are to make. If you look at some of the shorter channel lengths, you can see some, let's look at 100, the square here. If I look at 100, I think the square is this one, and at high VDS, it's this one. What's going on in that device? Yeah, it's punched through, right? It's just the gate is not able to shut the current off the way it's supposed to. So they're still, dealing with some, how do you design the junction depths and the 2D electrostatics so that you can control all of those. But there's a lot of work going on in this now, on this area now, and we'll see where it goes. So what's a heterostructure FET? Well, it has a similarity both to a gallium arsenide MESFET, in that it's got a Schottky barrier on the top. It's similar to a MOSFET, but they're really true 3-5 MOSFETs are a true research topic. It's not a commercial technology yet. But when people talk about heterostructure FETs, it is like a gallium arsenide MESFET with some heterojunctions in the channel. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. This is a well-developed commercial technology. Things like satellite receivers, probably used in cell phone repeaters and towers and things like that, where you need really high-frequency, high-performance devices. These are the devices that you use. And people are looking very seriously now as to whether these could be logic devices. That remains to be seen where all that's going. So since we're going to talk about heterojunction FETs, I need to review some things about heterojunctions. Have you all seen some heterojunctions in EE606 or somewhere like that? You know what a semiconductor heterojunction is? Some of you? Then this will just be review. So let's go back to a homojunction. By homojunction, it means both sides of the junction are made out of the same semiconductor. And we make these energy band diagrams. So we teach this in 305. We've got an N-type material here on the left, so the Fermi level is up near the conduction band. We have a P-type material here on the right, so the Fermi level is down by the valence band, and we ask what happens when we put the two together. Well, we know that the Fermi level is like a water level. Electrons are going to flow from the high Fermi level to the low Fermi level. And they're going to keep flowing until there's a potential drop that gets built up that'll stop them. And when that's done, there'll be one Fermi level. Everything will be in equilibrium. So What we have to do is to decrease the potential on the right side or increase the potential on the left side, because energy is minus Q times potential. So if I decrease the potential on the right side, I'll pull everything up until this blue Fermi level aligns with the red Fermi level and I'm in equilibrium. So how much does the potential drop have to be? Just the difference between these two bulk Fermi levels before we put them together. So that's the built-in potential of the p-n junction. And you've all done this before. We can do this. We can be a little more quantitative about this. I'm going to do it for a p-n junction so that you can see how it works for a heterojunction a little bit later. So let me call little delta sub n the separation between the Fermi level on the n side and the conduction band. And little delta sub p is a separation between the Fermi level on the p side and the valence band. So I need to find out the difference in those Fermi levels. That's my built-in potential. Okay. So EFN is EC minus this delta n. And EFP is valence band plus delta P, and we're subtracting EFP, so I get minus EF, I get EC minus EV minus delta P. Okay. So EC minus EV is band gap. So the built-in potential is just band gap minus delta N minus delta P. Delta N and delta P we can compute easily, because if we know the doping density, we know that the position of this Fermi level with respect to the band edge is related to the doping density. So we can compute delta N and delta P, put it all together, simplify things, and you find that the built-in potential is KT over Q log NA times ND over NI squared. One of the first things you'll learn in a p-n junction course. So after you get all done, there's one Fermi level. It's the green line here. There's a slope of the conduction band is the electric field. Slope of the valence band is also the electric field. And the total potential drop across here is the built-in potential, just how much we had to adjust things to make the Fermi level constant. Okay. Now, if I'm measuring energy, it's always reference to something. There has to be a reference for potential. There has to be a reference for energy. Why didn't I worry about our reference there? You know, what does EC equals zero mean? It's reference to something. The reason I didn't worry about it is because whatever it's reference to, it's the same for both sides. So when I subtract EFN minus EFP, the reference will drop out. And I never even had to think about what the reference was for the energy. But we have to be more careful with heterojunctions. There is some reference, one that is typically used, although it's got some conceptual problems that we won't go into now, is what is called the field-free vacuum level. So imagine that you pull an electron out of the conduction band and it away from the solid, and it becomes a free electron. It's now in the vacuum. And there's no electric field anywhere here. So we just pull it out. How much energy does it take to pull it out? That's called the electron affinity. So chi sub n, chi sub p, if it's a homojunction, they're the same. We pull them out. And then the work function is the distance between that reference and the vacuum and the Fermi level. So the built-in potential is also the difference between the work functions. And I just want to point out, if I want to know what EC is now, it's my reference energy, the vacuum level, maybe I'll call that zero, minus the electron affinity. And the valence band is the reference level minus the electron affinity minus the band gap. Now, I should mention there's something else we could call a local vacuum level. If I pull an electron out of the conduction band on the n side, It'll take the electron affinity and it'll be out. But if there's this potential difference between the N side and the P side, then the potential outside of the N-type semiconductor there has been lowered by that potential drop. So we'll call that the local vacuum level. Once there's a potential difference that gets set up between the N and the P regions, then there's a potential difference between a free electron in the vacuum on the N side and the P side, just lowered by whatever the electrostatic potential is. Okay. All right. So now our expressions for the position-dependent conduction band edge, it's the reference, minus the electron affinity, minus the electrostatic potential. The valence band is the same thing, minus the band gap. Okay. You take the slope of either one of these. Everything is constant except the electrostatic potential. So it's minus gradient of the potential. That's the electric field. All right. So those are things you're all familiar with. And then let's refresh our memories on heterojunctions. So let me take an aluminum gallium arsenide heterojunction. Put a little bit of aluminum into gallium arsenide, and you widen the band gap. And if you don't put too much in, the lattice is still matched pretty well, so no defects created at the interface. So if I have 30% aluminum, I'll have a wide band gap. I'll have some electron affinity that's now different from gallium arsenide, and I'll have a band gap that's bigger than gallium arsenide. And when I draw those energy band diagrams there, I have to be careful about my reference, right? Because I have to reference both of them to the same reference. So my reference is this field-free vacuum level. If the electron affinity on the gallium arsenide side is bigger than the electron affinity on the aluminum gallium arsenide, and it is, then the band diagram will look like this, and there will be an offset in the conduction bands. They won't line up. And the difference is just the difference between these two electron affinities. It's like a 10 kT over Q, so it's big. Subtracting that is called the electron affinity rule. And it's a simple way to estimate what this is. Now, people who actually look in detail at what the theory is, you know, they wonder that, well, how these conduction bands all line up at this interface is just determined by the local bonding and crystal structure and things that are going on there. Why bring in the vacuum? It hasn't got anything to do with this problem. Well, you bring in the vacuum because you need some reference. Okay. So people typically do it. It's not a good way to do it because the electron affinities, anybody know how big an electron affinity typically is? Yeah. So you're subtracting 4 point something minus 4 point something, and you're getting something that's like 5% of the difference. That's a good way to have huge errors. Because it's four plus or minus something, minus four plus point something, plus or minus something. You subtract the two, all right, and it's hard to get. So basically, what people feel they know are these discontinuities. They measure them by various techniques, and then you just kind of adjust everything here. You say, well, I don't really know the electron affinity that well, so I'll adjust it a little bit so that when I subtract the two, I get the right band offset. Because that's the important thing. There's a valence band offset too. And there are all kinds of, you know, different ways that these things can line up. You know, I could pull the gallium arsenide all the way down and have its conduction band below that. You know, I could have the valence band inside the band gap here. All different kinds of things can happen. And you get different energy band diagrams every time one of those happens. Okay, so let's dope this now and make a p-n junction and see what happens. So let's dope the n-type aluminum gallium arsenide. Let's dope the aluminum gallium arsenide n-type and the gallium arsenide p-type. So it's just like before. We have two different Fermi levels. Electrons are going to move from the high Fermi level to the low Fermi level. We'll set up a potential difference. When we're all done, everything will be aligned. There'll be one Fermi level. The built-in potential, just like it was before, will be the difference between Fermi level on the N side and the Fermi level on the P side. And when you get all done, what you'll find, you know, you can see when electrons leave the aluminum gallium arsenide, we have to show this side depleted. When they spill over into here, we have to show more electrons in the gallium arsenide, so the bands have to bend down. But the difference between the conduction band in the aluminum gallium arsenide and the conduction band in the gallium arsenide is a material parameter. That can't change. So we get something like this. N-type aluminum gallium arsenide becomes depleted because the electrons have spilled out. P-type gallium arsenide, electrons are piling up near the interface because they spilled over from the wide band gap layer. But that delta EC is still 0.24 electron volts. And the delta EV is whatever it was before. They never change. Okay, so we could go through, you have to be a little bit careful now. We could go through now and you can see that there is some potential drop here. And there is some potential drop here on the P side. There is some change in energy here, but it's not electrostatic. So my built-in potential is the sum of the potential drop on the N side and the potential drop on the P side. You can see if I took the slope of the energy band diagram here, I'd have the electric field. If I took the slope here, I'd have the electric field. If I tried to take the slope here, I'd have an impulse. If I graded it out, I wouldn't have an impulse, but I wouldn't have an electric field either, because that's due to compositional changes, not due to charges. All right, so that's what the band diagram looks like. And let's see what else. Oh, I could ask another question. You know, what happened? Take the same N-type layer and just dope the P-side really, really heavily. Now I'll have a one-sided junction. All the band bending will occur on the N-type side. There won't be much band bending that can occur at all there. And I'll get something that'll look like that. When we talk about HBTs, this will be the energy band diagram that we're worried about, and we'll see that it's possible to have a spike there, and that changes the PN junction IV characteristics a lot. But we're not talking about PN junctions today. So this is the kind of heterojunction that we're going to talk about for FETs. It's like the one we talked about. We'll have an N-type wide band gap layer, and the small band gap layer, gallium arsenide in this case, will be lightly doped P-type or intrinsic. Usually when people grow these things, if they don't intentionally dope them, they turn out to be lightly doped P-type. The Fermi level will be somewhere near the middle of the conduction band. What happens when you put these together? You get a band diagram that looks like the one we showed earlier. And notice that what we've done now is we have an inversion layer of electrons on the P-type or undoped gallium arsenide side. That could be a channel of a FET. Okay. This is called modulation doping because in a MESFET, I doped the channel N-type and then I put a Schottky barrier on it. Here we dope this wide band gap layer, which is not supposed to be our channel. It has low mobility, it's not high quality. The gallium arsenide is intrinsic. It has no dopants to scatter carriers. It has very high mobility. It's just that it doesn't have any electrons. But now when I make a heterojunction like this, I dope a region to get the carriers. They spill over into the intrinsic, lightly doped region. Now I have a lot of carriers there, but I don't have the ionized dopants to scatter them. So I should be able to get a lot of carriers and a high mobility at the same time. This is called modulation doping. It's a really clever idea. The electrons here, it's just like the inversion layer of electrons in a MOSFET. The people who did this like to refer to this as a two-dimensional electron gas. It's just like an inversion layer in a MOSFET, no different. Okay, so we've got a depletion layer on the wide band gap side and an inversion layer. If it's lightly doped N-type, we'd call it an accumulation layer. Doesn't really matter. It's slightly doped. There wasn't much there in the first time. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this modulation doping. That's the key idea in making these field effect transistors that we're interested in talking about. So the idea is to take a wide band gap layer. These days it tends to be indium aluminum arsenide more often than gallium arsenide, and a small band gap layer that's lightly doped, not intentionally doped. These days it's usually gallium indium arsenide instead of gallium arsenide. It has a little bit smaller band gap and higher mobility than gallium arsenide. But the band diagrams look like this. And the idea is we dope one region to get a lot of carriers, and we let them spill over into the region that we want them in, that we're going to make a transistor out of. Okay. So if you look at some of the early papers where people first invented this, when I was a graduate student, this was the latest research. People were just discovering how to do this. And it was a really neat idea. Okay. So the way you build a field effect transistor then is if we're doing it on gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide, you have a semi-insulating substrate. So this is like SOI in silicon. But it's easy to get a semi-insulating substrate in gallium arsenide. And you probably grow by epitaxy an intrinsic gallium arsenide layer just to get you away from the substrate so you have a really high quality clean layer. And then we grow on top of that a wide band gap aluminum gallium arsenide layer, and we dope it. And by modulation doping, then electrons spill over into this purple layer, which is the two-dimensional electron gas in the small band gap layer. And we put a Schottky barrier on the top. And the Schottky barrier depletes through and allows us to either have more or less carriers in that purple 2D electron gas. And that's what's going to make our FET. So it's like a MESFET. There's no insulator. But the conduction doesn't come in the layer right under the Schottky barrier. It comes in this small band gap modulation doped layer. All right, so that red layer there is the wide band gap layer. Now, there's an interesting technique. Sometimes people use something they call delta doping. Instead of just doping it uniformly, while you're doing the epitaxy, you can stop. You can do the epitaxy without any dopants, and then you can stop. And you can turn on the dopants, and you can saturate one atomic plane with dopants. Just one atomic plane. And you can turn off the dopants and grow again. And you could, if you're careful and the temperature isn't too high, keep the dopants right there, and you've got dopants in one atomic plane. And it's sort of, you know, you wait long enough and they all find their right place, so you can control the concentration very well. And it's a nice controlled way to do precise doping. And people use that very frequently these days. So what they'll quote to you frequently is not the doping density per cubic centimeter in the wide bandgap layer. They'll quote the doping per square centimeter in this plane. But it doesn't really matter. We still have the same number of electrons in the layer. We've just put them all in one plane. And it still produces this 2D electron gas in the gallium arsenide. So these kinds of transistors go by lots of different names. The one that I like best is MOSFET, although it doesn't seem to be used as much these days, because it tells you, you know, what the device is based on. It's based on this concept of modulation doping. It's also called a high electron mobility transistor. I think it was first demonstrated in Japan, and that's what they called it, because modulation doping is a way to get very high mobilities, higher than you would have expected for that number of carriers. And people have other names. For every lab that does this had to come up with its own name. Selectively doped heterostructure transistor, a TEGFET, two-dimensional electron gas transistor. I think the one that's most, you hear most these days is HEMT. Sometimes you hear MOSFET. Sometimes you hear just heterostructure FET. But they're all referring to the same device. Yeah. Why do we get higher mobilities is your question. Is that right? It's because the electrons are sitting in a region that is not doped. Therefore, they're not going to experience ionized impurity scattering. Typically, when you want to put electrons in a semiconductor, you dope it. Now, the disadvantage of that is now you're left behind those charged dopants that can scatter the electrons that you want to make use of. This is a technique where you dope one layer, the charged dopants are there, and they spill over into the pure layer that you want them to be in. That isn't quite true, as we'll talk about in a minute, but that's the idea. That's why you get a much higher mobility. Now, initially, so it's interesting, you know, when you get old, you see things coming around two or three times. Initially, this was all driven by trying to beat silicon CMOS for digital logic. Could we build better transistors? And people were doing 3-5 digital ICs and inventing devices like this. Now, it turned out silicon was really hard to compete with. But they were developed into important commercial technologies for RF applications, and there's a viable industry. Not as big as the silicon, but it's big, it makes money, it's viable. Nowadays, people are coming back and looking at it again, very frequently in technology. You know, an idea that doesn't make a lot of sense at one time, you know, 10 or 20 years later, things have changed. You know, that technology has matured. The dominant technology is experiencing a new set of problems. Sometimes the best thing to do if you're looking for research problems is to go back and read electron devices 30 years ago and see if there are some ideas there that were ahead of their time. So there's a lot of interest right now on going back and doing this. And if you're interested in reading some of the original papers and some, you know, they do a very good job. The latest one I could find was 1992. So, and what you're seeing now, if you look at papers, is as far as RF is concerned, there's been a lot of progress, but the basic operating physics is well established. If you go back to these papers, that hasn't changed. There's been work on materials, so higher indium content materials with higher mobilities. But if you read papers these days, more of them will be about the potential of using these in digital logic. So they'll be talking about on-current and things like that that these papers never talked about because they were RF papers. And you can find textbook treatments of this also. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about how you would produce one of these structures. I don't want to go through, if this were a course on heterostructure FETs, we'd spend about a week probably doing electrostatics and learning how you dope these films and learning how to compute how many carriers you get in the channel. And it's all just Poisson's equation and delta depletion approximations and things like that. I'm not going to go through all of that, but let's just establish a few considerations here. So let's say we have a wide bandgap layer doped uniformly to 10 to the 18th. We've got a Schottky barrier on the surface. Or maybe this film even is just a bare surface where the Fermi level is pinned. That means that there is going to be some depletion region from the surface, W sub S. It's going to deplete into that wide bandgap layer. Okay, then we've got a PN junction between the wide bandgap layer and the nominally undoped small bandgap layer. So there's some depletion region on both sides of that PN junction. That's the band bending when we did the energy band diagram. So that's W. And depending on how thick we made that wide bandgap layer, those two depletion regions might overlap, or they might not even meet, and there might be a doped region in the middle. Frequently, almost always, people will not put the doped wide bandgap layer right up against the small bandgap layer. they'll have a thin spacer, which is undoped. And we'll talk about that in a minute. And then we have our 2D electron gas. And the question is, what is the inversion layer density? How many electrons per square centimeter? And this region here is actually this undepleted region in the wide band gap layer isn't a good thing to have because it's a parallel channel and it's not a high mobility parallel channel. So it degrades the overall performance. You want this 2D electron gas, this modulation doped layer to be the channel. You don't want this extra channel there. So if we do the energy band diagram for this, it would look something like this. Since the two depletion regions didn't go all the way through the film, there's some region in the middle of the wide band gap layer that's just N-type and giving me that undesirable channel. There's some barrier height at the Schottky barrier. There's some width of the surface depletion region. There's some width of the depletion region around the p-n junction. There's some band discontinuity. And all of these parameters go into figuring out how many electrons you have in the inversion layer. There's some band bending in the small band gap layer that's just like psi s in the MOS problem. And the electrons are quantum confined. It's even a stronger effect than in silicon because the effective masses are lighter, so the quantum confinement effects are more pronounced. So you have subbands in there. And that's why it's called a 2D electron gas.
Not like an accumulation of electron accumulation layer.
You know, the small band gap layer is lightly doped, so if there happened to be some residual impurities in the film while you were going and it came out N-type, then we might call it an accumulation layer. If the residual impurities happen to make it lightly P-type, we might call it an inversion layer. But it really doesn't matter. Right? It's a lightly doped region. Okay. And this parallel conduction path, as I mentioned, is something you definitely want to avoid. And that means you need to choose the thickness of this wide bandgap layer such that it is no thicker than the sum of these two depletion regions. And for example, if you made it exactly the right thickness, then those two depletion regions would meet. If you made it a little thinner than that, then they would actually overlap and the conduction band would be a little bit higher. Okay, so as I mentioned, we could go through and we could do some analytical calculations and we could compute how many electrons there are in the inversion layer. And it would depend on the doping in the Algas layer, it would depend on how thick it is, it would depend on the conduction band discontinuity and all of those things. But to do it really well, you need to do it numerically. Solve Schrodinger's and Poisson's equations self-consistently. And as I said, we're not going to go through that, but you can, you can sort of see what the important considerations are going to be. If we put a spacer layer in there, then the thicker the spacer layer is, that's going to inhibit the transfer of charge into the small band gap layer. So there's the trade-off. We'll talk about why we want that spacer layer in a minute. But if you make it too thick, you won't end up putting many electrons in the small band gap layer. If there's a big discontinuity in the conduction band, that's helpful because that helps encourage the electrons to fall down in energy and go into the small band gap layer. So if you did the calculations and compute the built-in potential and everything, you could compute the built-in potential, and the higher the built-in potential, the more beneficial it would be for electrons to transfer. These difference in Fermi levels are just determined by the doping, the delta EC. Delta EC we want to be high, right? Not just to promote the transfer, but also to keep those electrons in the small band gap layer where the mobility is high. Now, in SiO2, that number, how big is that number? What's the conduction, what's the barrier height between silicon and SiO2?
899.
band gap, I think, is about 8 to 9 eV. So something like half of it. It doesn't divide equally, but something like 3 to 4 eV in the conduction band. Right? There's a huge barrier. The electrons rarely get out of the channel into the SiO2. They can. That's a reliability problem, but it's, you know, it's a small effect. Here, this band discontinuity is typically a few tenths of an electron volt. You know, so if the electrons get out of that inversion layer and into the wide band gap layer, they have a much lower mobility, and that doesn't help at all. Okay. So let's see. That's what the band diagram looks like. Oh, this is what the band diagram looks like. Let's say we've designed everything just the way we want it. Well, we've designed it in equilibrium. Fermi level is the same everywhere. The two depletion regions and thickness, we've got it so that there's no parallel conduction path. We've got electrons in the inversion layer there so we can make a good transistor. Now what happens if we apply a negative gate voltage? So a negative voltage is going to raise the Fermi level in the metal Schottky barrier. It'll push electrons out of the wide band gap layer and deplete it even more. It'll reach through and pull up the potential inside here too. So it'll reduce the number of electrons. It'll deplete the channel. Right? Negative voltage on the gates, it makes sense. It'll push electrons out of everywhere. So then we're depleting the device. How about if we go positive? If we go positive, we pull the Fermi level in the metal down. That pulls everything down, including the conduction band and the small band gap layer, and it puts even more carriers in. So that's like a positive voltage on an N-channel MOSFET. You get more carriers in the inversion layer. So you enhance the 2D electron gas. Now, if you apply too positive of a voltage, you know, now you're forward biasing this Schottky barrier, so your depletion region comes back. Now you might uncover a neutral region, and now you have a parallel conduction channel. Now the performance of the transistor will degrade, its transconductance will drop, because you've got a low mobility channel in parallel with a high mobility channel, and that's not good. If you increase the gate voltage even more, your forward bias Schottky barrier will start to conduct, and you'll get gate leakage. That's why you would rather have a gallium arsenide MOSFET, so you don't have to worry about that problem. All right. Okay, I don't think I want to go. I want to say a little bit, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of interesting device physics here, but you could ask, you know, under forward bias, what kind of charges do you have here? Well, you have, normally when we dope semiconductors, we get in the habit. We get lazy and we get in the habit of thinking that, well, if I dope an N-type, all of the dopants are ionized. But whenever you work on a new material system, you have to go back. Some of those assumptions that work well for silicon at room temperature don't necessarily work well. Turns out that the dopants are fairly deep in these wide band gap layers, meaning that if the Fermi level is up here above the dopant energy, that these dopants aren't all ionized. Some of them are neutral. The electrons are now sitting on the dopants, so they're not participating in conduction. So that's an important part. So we have free charges in the inversion layer. We have free charges in the wide band gap layer. But we also have bound charges. And it's just, you know, this is something you've probably learned in 606, how to figure out what fraction of the dopants are ionized and what fraction have an electron sitting on them and are neutral. Right? And that's important in these layers. So if you look at the inversion layer charge in a structure like this, it would look just like a MOSFET in that 2D electron gas. But if you keep raising the gate voltage up high, you will have some charges in the wide band gap layer, some electrons that are bound to the dopants, and some electrons in that layer that are free. And you've got to account for all of those charges. So, for example, if we could compute this ratio, dN dV is like a capacitance. If we take the derivative of the inversion layer charge with respect to the gate voltage, we're getting like a semiconductor capacitance. But we have these other charges in the layer that are also changing as a function of gate bias. So if I add up all of the charges, that gives me a total capacitance. In a MOSFET, the total capacitance is associated with the inversion layer charge above threshold. Here, only some fraction eta is, because you're charging and discharging dopants in the wide band gap layer. So your modulation efficiency drops. Because you do a delta gate voltage, and what that does is it gives you a delta charge in the wide band gap layer, not in your channel. Okay, let's talk a minute about scattering mechanisms. The whole point of doing this is that you want to put electrons in an intrinsic region where their mobility should be high. So you dope one region, you let them spill into another region. Now, electrostatically, electrons in the small band gap region will still be able to see the charged dopants in the wide band gap layer, even though they're spatially separated. They're further away, so it's not going to be as strong an effect as if they were, if these dopants were sitting in the channel, but it will still lower the mobility somewhat. That's what this spacer layer is typically for. You set the dopants back away from the channel so that their electrostatic fields are less pronounced and they have less of an effect to reduce the mobility. Now, of course, the wider you make that undoped layer, the more you reduce the scattering and the higher your mobility is. But the harder it is for the charge to spill into that channel, so the less charge you have. Current, you know, is going to depend on charge times velocity. Velocity depends on mobility. So there's a trade-off. You can have a lot of charge, but your mobility will suffer. Or you can have very little charge, and you can get enormous mobilities. And device designers will pick some region to operate in. And then there are other scattering mechanisms like lattice vibrations that are going to be there that you don't remove by this technique. But they're still there. And there's one other, you know, one of the strong scattering mechanisms in silicon is surface roughness scattering. When you oxidize silicon, you create an atomically rough surface that does a lot of scattering. That's why the mobility in a MOSFET is about 100 instead of 1300 or something. One of the nice things about these epitaxially grown lattice match systems is you could have almost atomically flat interfaces. Every now and then you'll have a step of one monolayer or so. So there will be a little bit of interface scattering, but it will be dramatically lower than SiO2, which is another reason that the mobilities can be high. All right. So people refer to this as remote impurity scattering because the impurities that are scattering these electrons in the channel are located somewhere else. So if you plot mobility versus temperature, and this is what an experimentalist would do to characterize any kind of semiconductor film they've grown, you typically get curves that look like this dashed line. At low temperatures, the mobility increases with temperature. And we explain that how? Yeah. And physically what happens is as you increase the temperature, electrons are zipping around at the thermal velocity faster and faster. So they zip by those charged impurities faster and they're not deflected as much. So the mobility improves as you get it hotter and hotter. Eventually, you get hot enough that you've excited so many lattice vibrations that they control the mobility. Now the hotter you go, the more and more lattice vibrations you get and the mobility turns around. So you get curves that look like this. For bulk gallium arsenide, you can get a mobility of close to 10,000 at room temperature in pure gallium arsenide. But at liquid nitrogen temperatures, you get mobilities that are up around 100,000. Okay. So let's see what we can... So what happens if we have a small spacer layer, what we get are basically at room temperature, you know, we get almost the mobility of bulk gallium arsenide, even though we haven't doped it. That's the nice part about it. As you go lower and lower in temperature,
you know, you reach a point where the mobility doesn't go any higher because you suffer from this remote impurity scattering. Okay. If you make the thickness of the spacer layer even higher, yeah, then you can get mobilities at room temperature that are very close to pure gallium arsenide. But as you cool it, you can go much, much higher before the remote impurity scattering starts to become important, and you can't go any higher than that. So you can easily get mobilities of a million. And I quit paying attention. You know, there was a big contest for a while to see which lab could make the highest mobilities. And I don't know what the record is. It's probably 10 million, though. You can just get enormous mobilities this way. Yeah.
The electric field, you know, you might operate on the range, and the number 5 or something, what percentage?
Yeah.
Then you get speed, close to speed of light.
You're worried that if you take mu times the electric field, you'll exceed, you'll get too high? Yeah. Yeah, so they're very high mobilities. And, you know, you remember if you take mobility versus electric field in a bulk semiconductor, you don't extrapolate up that linear thing to too high electric fields, because some other scattering mechanisms always come in when you get more energy and limit you to some velocity, which at, you know, it's something like 10 to the 7th centimeters per second. So we're only talking about the mobilities down here in this regime. So some, you know, depending on what kind of device you're building, that's important. Even for a transistor, it's important under low VDS. But there will be some saturated velocity under high VDS. Yeah. If you get in 3.5s, this is silicon. In 3.5s in the bulk, you start having enough energy that they scatter up into these upper valleys that have lower effective masses and things like that. But, you know, people who grow materials, you know, they measure the mobility down here because it's some measure of the intrinsic quality of your device. It's important for part of the transistor IV characteristic. If you have a 10 million mobility, your mean free path is enormously long. People, you know, did experiments on ballistic transport or experiments on electron optics, where you can think of, you know, you can do optical, you can build devices that are analogous to optical devices because the electron is not scattering. You think of it as a wave. So there are all kinds of interesting things you can do when your mobility is 10 million. Okay, so what do the IV characteristics look like? So here I can be very brief, because it's a transistor, right? All you've done is to produce a transistor and an inversion layer with a different technique. But it's basically going to behave like a transistor. So you would expect it to behave similarly. And people build models that look very much like MOSFET models. The insulator capacitance here, this is basically the capacitance of, it's epsilon over that thickness of that wide band gap layer. You think about that like an insulator. There's some mobility. It's the mobility of the 2D electron gas. You go high enough, and the mobility doesn't matter. There's some saturated velocity, things like that. And you get IV characteristics. People typically in these materials find a saturated velocity that can be 2 to 3 times higher than what you get in silicon. That's very nice. That's one of the motivations for going to these indium-rich materials, is that they have especially high saturation velocities. If you go to large VGS, you know, then you have this problem that you have these parallel conduction paths that you have to worry about. So then the simple expression no longer holds. Because you have to worry, I can always write the current as width times some overall average velocity times some overall electron density, some of which might be in the wide band gap layer and some of which might be in the inversion layer where I want them. And then if we did the transconductance, We would just differentiate that with respect to gate voltage. And remember when we did that, we said that, you know, this is normally what we think of as the gate capacitance, derivative of inversion charge with respect to gate voltage. But now we've got all of those charges in the wide band gap layer. Some of them are on the dopant, some of them aren't. And when you account for all of those, you get some fraction eta that's less than one, because not all of your delta VG is going into an increase in the inversion layer. Some of it is going into this parallel layer. So the performance suffers if you allow that to happen. And but if you design the device right, then this doesn't happen, and you can get very high transconductances. But when you have very high transconductances, then you're very sensitive to series resistance. So you've got to pay a lot of attention to that as well. Okay, so the last thing I'm going to do is just show a recent structure. And these are actually a couple of years old now. The group has very similar structures that have much better results. They'll probably talk about some even better results at the IEDM meeting next week. But this is what the structure looks like. So it's an indium gallium arsenide HEMT. And let's see. So they typically build them now on indium phosphide substrates, wide band gap. Okay. And then there is an even wider band gap indium aluminum arsenide layer. This is like an SOI structure. It's a wide band gap layer that keeps everything away from the substrate. The channel itself is an indium gallium arsenide channel. Put some indium in instead of aluminum, and it shrinks the band gap down low, makes the effective mass lighter, makes the mobility even higher. So that's our high mobility channel. And sometimes people embed in this channel quantum wells and even smaller band gap materials to get even higher mobility. Then there is another wide band gap layer. This is what we think of like our insulator in the MOSFET. And they delta dope it. So there's a plane of dopants instead of doping it uniformly. The electrons in this plane of dopants are going to spill over into this small band gap layer and modulation dope it. That automatically gives me my source and drain. I don't have to ion implant. I don't have to dope by a technique. Well, you modulation dope. You dope the wide band gap layer, they spill down into there. There is an indium gallium arsenide cap, and sometimes right on the top there would even be a smaller band gap pure indium arsenide layer. That's to help make ohmic contact. It's always easier to make an ohmic contact to a small band gap material than to a big band gap material. But you etch that away from the transistor itself. The transistor, let's see. The contacts here are gold, germanium, nickel, and that creates an alloy that gives you a good ohmic contact. You etch away the small band gap layer where you're going to build the transistor. You deposit a Schottky barrier, which is titanium, platinum, gold, and it has this T-gate structure. So people work very hard. So if this is going to end up being 80 nanometers or 50 nanometers or something, your channel length, you mushroom it out and make it big. And people develop processes to do that. So why do they do that? Why do they want to have such an unusual... Yeah. Remember we talked about gate resistance and that RC time constant? Especially for RF applications, you need a low resistance gate. But you want the channel length to be very narrow, but then you use this mushroom gate structure to make to lower the gate resistance. Let's see, this is what a film looks like. So these things are grown epitaxially, you know, they get a little bit complicated. This is a 3-inch indium phosphide substrate. Now this is a slightly different, but similar structure to the one I showed before. So there's a buffer layer. Then the channel structure. So it's indium 53%, gallium 47% arsenide, And that gives you a moderate band gap. I think it's 6 or 7 tenths of an EV, if I remember right. Then there is an 8 nanometer thick indium-rich material, 0.7. Even smaller band gap, even lighter effective mass, even higher mobility. So we really hope that the electrons spend most of their time here. We get the most performance. Then there's another wider band gap layer. Then there is a spacer, 3 nanometers. This is undoped, and this is to improve the mobility. Before we put the delta doped layer, so we put the dopants here, they're now 3 nanometers away. Help lower the mobility. Then we've got another barrier to confine everything here. An etch layer here that's called the stopper. And I think its only purpose is that when you're producing these structures, you have to selectively etch various layers, and you have chemicals that etch one material and don't etch another. So sometimes you insert layers that are just there so that you can etch and stop at a point, and they don't necessarily serve an electronic function. And then there is a cap layer here that is doped very heavily and is simply for ohmic contact. Okay. And that will be etched away underneath the channel, but it's going to perform. It's a quantum well structure, doped very heavily, trying to make low resistance contact. So here's what the process looks like. That epitaxial film is in a region like this. We etch it away and define our active regions. We can put the metallization then over the edges for the source and the drain, because that contacting structure was on the top here. Then we can define a pattern in probably a 3-layer resist here, so that we define a pattern on the bottom, and then we etch through those contacting layers. And then we have a different resist layer here that when we develop it, it develops out and gives us a fat layer, and that helps produce this mushroom contact. So then when you do the gate deposition, we'll have our gate deposited to the channel quantum well structure. It'll flare out in this big region, and this is what that mushroom gate structure then looks like. Physical gate length is about 100 nanometers. Okay. And here's what the IV characteristics look like. So the whole motivation in these devices is to see whether you can get good on current at much lower power supply voltages. So silicon is now stuck at 1 volt, and power is proportional to VDD squared. If you could produce a device that gives you adequate on current at much lower VDD, say you could do it at 0.5, you'd have a quarter of the power, which would be a very big deal. So that's the driving force for this. And you can see that transistor characteristics look pretty much like MOSFET characteristics. These are actually quite good numbers, for a technology that's still in the lab and just maturing. At 0.4 volts, you're getting close to a half a milliamp per micrometer. It's half of what a high-performance silicon does at a significantly lower voltage. So it's quite promising. Subthreshold characteristics, I think, are close to 60 millivolts per decade. Dibble is really low. So people are working, Dibble is 70. So people are working very hard to try to make 3-5 transistors that outperform silicon transistors. Okay, so the one thing we shouldn't lose track of is that this is really a mature and well-established commercial technology for RF application. People build these microwave chips. They do all kinds of various types of circuits. You use them commercially, you use them in military applications, in space. You can see what's happened to the cutoff frequency versus year. You can see what's happening with CMOS. It was below 100 gigahertz in 1994. It's in this plot, it's over 300. It just continues to get higher and higher as CMOS channels are shrunk down more and more. There's some HBTs here that we will talk about on Thursday, but then this red line are 3-5 HEMPs, and you know, this is a plot that's a couple of years old now. I think maybe a few years old. But you can see that the FTs are up around 600 gigahertz. And I think people have done better since that. You know, so the goal is to try to hit a terahertz. So these things are getting remarkably fast. Okay, so hopefully when you go to a conference and somebody talks about HEMPs, you know what they mean now, what the device structure is. If you need to find out more about them, I've given you some references. So what you should take away is the fact that it's not a laboratory technology. It's a well-established commercial technology that's been around for a long time, continues to get better and better every year. It is not used for mainline digital applications, but it is needed when you need the various highest frequency performance. And then right now, the big question in everybody's mind is, can you take this technology and can you adapt it to digital? And can you substantially beat what could be achieved with silicon CMOS in the next few years? Okay. Any questions? Yes. Can you make P-channel HEMPs? I think people have made P-channel HEMPs, I think. You don't typically see them because, you know, if you look at the band diagram, at the EK relation for semiconductors, 3.5s have this gamma valley with very light effective masses. That's what gives you the high mobility and all of the wonderful characteristics for electrons. If you look at the valence bands, all semiconductors pretty much have the same valence band structure. So the mobilities are quite low. So it means that, you know, in silicon, we've historically dealt with this 2-to-3 ratio between N-channel and P-channel, although because of strain, it's getting closer to 1-to-1. One of the issues here is that there'll be a big mismatch between the N-channel and whatever you use for the P-channel. Oh, yeah. So people are looking at ideas. You know, what can you do for P-channel? So they're thinking about straining 3.5s, you know, what that might do. They're thinking about germanium. Germanium is a material that has an unusually high P-type mobility. So it's a big question. I don't know if anybody knows the answer. But, yeah, this is only the N-channel part of CMOS. Yes? Capacitance voltage characteristics. Yeah. And what is the question?
So how does this compare to the CMOS?
Yeah, I haven't thought too much about what the CV characteristics of these structures look like. I mean, you'd have a region with depletion, and you'd have a region with inversion, and you couldn't go too high in voltage, or your gate would start to conduct. I would think as long as you didn't forward bias the Schottky barrier or reverse bias it to break on, it would look similar. But you may have to worry, but quantitatively, you know, you may have to worry a little more about these details that you have. Your insulating layer is doped, right? And the dopants in there have a large donor energy, so they can become partially ionized, and that affects the capacitance. So that's probably something you need to worry about quantitatively that's different than SiO2. Which isn't dope. Speak up, please. Yeah, and there were, you know, there's, if you want to see the latest results, a structure very similar to the one I showed here
as reported by Intel in the October Electron device letters. And they tried to compare it against CMOS. And you know, they showed a performance advantage over current day CMOS. Yeah.
Does drain current always have linear separation with VGS?
Pardon me?
Does the drain current always have linear separation with VGS?
I would expect, you know, just like any short channel silicon transistor. Is it your question is, does it always look like that? The ones I see do. You know, I think you'd expect, you know, that's a signature of a velocity saturated FET. So it works just like a silicon one, I think. The only difference is that the saturation velocity is hopefully significantly higher. But the fact that the velocity saturates means that it's the characteristic is linear. Okay, any other question?
We are just trying to put more indium contents for higher mobility and also lower band gap, so more carriers in the channel. Both reasons or just one?
Yeah, I mean we're getting into some trade-offs here. So we've discussed this in silicon, that you have a gate insulator in series with a semiconductor capacitance. And because of that, the gate capacitance is lower than you would have thought. Right. Now, it turns out that semiconductor capacitance depends on the effective mass. You know, there's trade-off, you don't get anything for free. The lighter the effective mass, the higher the mobility, the higher the velocities, that's all wonderful. The lower the semiconductor capacitance. So when you put it in series with an insulator, you get a much lower capacitance than you would for silicon. So this is the big question in these 3.5s now. You're going to have a much lower inversion layer charge, but you're going to have much higher velocities. Is the product of the two better than silicon? Right? That Intel paper in October seemed to say, yeah, you can design things so that the product still beats silicon. But okay, see you on Thursday.